Welcome to The Great Awakening. I'm your host, Josh Dawes. My guest today is pastor and writer C.R. Wiley. He is the author of a great little book called The Household and the War for the Cosmos. His writing can be found all over the place. He's written for First Things, for World Opinions, National Review Online. I think he's got some stuff over at American Reformer, and as well as, you know, several other books. So he's a very prolific writer. He's a deep thinker. He writes a lot about family and the household and kind of how to think about that as a Christian. So earlier this year, I was preparing for an equipping class at our church on, you know, for parenting. And I decided, let's get back to the nuts and bolts. Like, what is the point of a Christian family, a Christian home? And remembered reading Chris's book several years ago and thought, oh man, he'd be a great guest to have on the podcast to talk about the Christian household. And so, you know, earlier this week, we sat down, had a great discussion that kind of ranged all over the place and ended up in places I wasn't expecting, but it was a lot of fun. And so I was grateful for Chris to come on. I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. But before we jump into that, I want to tell you about an opportunity for teens coming up this summer. Hey, Christian teen, ready to level up your understanding of life, culture, and the kingship of Christ? Make plans to attend the Ezra Worldview Youth Academy this summer. Transform your worldview, stimulate your Christian critical thinking, and engage with like-minded peers. There's two options available: the Worldview Youth Academy USA, July 12th through 18th in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, and the Worldview Youth Academy Canada, July 28th through August 2nd in Port Colborne, Ontario. Register now at EzraInstitute.com. All right, let's jump right into my conversation with Chris. Thanks for joining me, Chris.
Glad to be with you, Josh. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I've been wanting to have you for a long time. I read your book, Man of the House, several years ago, and it really helped shape a lot of the ways I started thinking about household. And that's something that you know, I've been thinking a lot about. So you've also written another book,
Household and War for the Cosmos. Is that the one you're thinking about?
That's the one, yeah. So you're kind of a expert on household and productive household. So I wanted to have you on just to talk about that, because I think a lot of times, you know, we kind of take that for granted. And so let's just start there. Like, what is the household? Why should we think about that?
Yeah, I think it's something that in the history of the West, but not just the West, civilization, you know, largely speaking, and that would mean the East and even other parts of the world like Africa and South America and so forth. A household is the fundamental building block of the civilization. And it's originally a productive enterprise and was intended to be productive in just about every way you can think of, including producing children. So the individual was not considered the starting place. This is a modern development. And the story of modernity has been in part the relegation of the household to the periphery and its disassembly, so that the state can take a more comprehensive or total role in our lives. Now, it's never put that way. It's always put, you know, this is progress, this is freedom, that kind of stuff. This is equality, depending on the regime. But it, in effect, this is what has happened.
Yeah, I started thinking about this again recently when I had to teach a parenting class for our church. And I went back to Bavinck and was kind of just starting at the root, like, what is the purpose of the family? And it really kind of opened my eyes to this kind of distinction between the creation mandate and the Great Commission. And it kind of struck me as, I've always kind of thought they were separate, but that the creation mandate was kind of done. You know, that was given to Adam. He's put on this big empty planet, you know, make something of this. And then here we are today, you know, we're enjoying the fruits of that dominion, you know, civilization has been conquered. And now our job is kind of shifted to the, you know, the Great Commission. And so right. there's no, you know, call for a Christian to, you know, take dominion anymore. But in studying that and going back to Bavinck and reading about the Christian family, the household kept coming up as the initial realm where we are to take dominion. Can you talk about that and the kind of how that works with the Great Commission? How are those distinct and separate?
Yeah, I just to be clear in terms of my own intellectual journey, I didn't start with Bavinck. I started with Aristotle. And so when I was working on one of the graduate programs I was in, I was working in Aristotle's Politics. And you can't read Aristotle's Politics without noting the centrality of the household. And at the same time, I was coming into the Reformed faith and looking and considering the sort of the structure of covenant theology. And I noted that, you know, theological framework, the household is also central. I think one of the weird things about contemporary Reformed theology is there has been an attempt by some people to abstract covenant theology in such a way so as to make the household kind of, it's no longer central. Everything's been abstracted to the point where we're just dealing with concepts and not with lived reality, life, husbands, wives, children, et cetera. Yeah, we baptize babies, but you know, that's just kind of happens mysteriously somehow, rather than thinking of our households as bearers of the covenant, you know, and participating in the covenant. Getting back to your question about the relationship between evangelism and the dominion mandate. Well, what we're given in the dominion mandate is a universal call to human beings to go out and through Adam, of course, to exercise dominion. And that's something to think about. I think sometimes a way we approach even that matter is more modern than we suppose. But then there's a fall, of course, and then there is a restoration, which is what the good news is. So the good news doesn't, supplant the work of dominion. It restores it. So I think with that kind of approach, in my mind, makes the idea that these things are pulling us in different directions kind of crazy. It just doesn't make sense theologically, eschatologically, even with, you know, in terms of human nature and what we're made to do and these kinds of things. So evangelism and dominion go together. If that helps.
Yeah.
That's the way I think about it.
That's good. I'm, you know, Southern Baptist. I kind of grew up, I'm a pastor's kid. And growing up, it always seemed like, I don't know, that ministry was something that happened outside the home. That, you know, if the kind of people we would celebrate in church were the people that, you know, had the prison ministry or, you know, they were doing the, you know, the whatever, backyard Bible clubs, things, you know, after school ministries.
Yeah. And what we celebrate are, you know, people who wandered, you know, deep in sin, far from the peaceful shore for a long, long time, which is kind of weird when you think about it. So what we're doing here is we're focusing attention on people who were sinners for a long, long time before they got their act together, rather than holding up people who, you know, were covenant children and, were not drug addicts and not, you know, not sexually promiscuous and et cetera, et cetera. There's a kind of a weird, I've heard referred to as testimony envy. On Sunday night at the church and everybody's getting up and sharing, you know, their testimony. And we all wish we were that guy. Man, it's so cool that he was like a hitman. Isn't that great? No, it's not. That's not good at all. It's great that he's been saved from that. Sure. Yeah, we can celebrate that. But we shouldn't revel in our sins so that we can, you know, praise the Lord.
Yeah, no, I've totally done that before. Just like, yeah, my testimony's boring. And I'm kind of frustrated about that. But yeah.
Yeah, we should celebrate boring testimonies.
Yeah.
You know, that's great.
Yeah, and those come from raising our kids in the Lord. Sure. And that is such an important ministry. Why do you think that churches kind of tend to overlook that?
Well, there are a lot of things that come into play. One is, I think, something that we can be grateful for, and that's an enthusiasm for reaching people who don't know Christ. I think that's something we shouldn't ever denigrate. But at the same time, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that we're called to raise our children in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord, you know, see them as part of the growth of the church, not kind of like a second rate kind of thing or an assumed thing. Mm-hmm. I think that these things go together. You know, be fruitful and multiply is, you know, wrapped up in that. So when it comes to the growth of the church, I've noticed that some people seem to emphasize conversion growth at the expense of biological growth. And what ends up happening is you get what you kind of reward, and oftentimes there's not much interest in or investment in the next generation. We're so concerned about making sure that we're not offending, you know, somebody outside the church who doesn't even like us, rather than attending to the work of you know, bringing children into the world who will glorify God in the next generation. Mm-hmm. So, I'll name names. I'm not at all hesitant to do that. I've been at Tim Keller's church maybe, you know, 3-4 times. It's essentially a youth group for people in their 30s and 40s, largely single people in New York City who put their career ahead of everything else. That's the fact. If you showed up in at Redeemer with a line of children behind you, you know, maybe they'd accept 2, but when you get into 3, you get raised eyebrows. By the time you get to 6 and 7, you'd be invited not to come back. That kind of stuff. I've had friends who've gotten that kind of cold shoulder there. Now, you know, people can turn that around and say that people, maybe churches like mine, would be uncomfortable for, say, a single person. You know, the median age of my church is about 17. And so it's just full of kids. We're just little rugrats running around everywhere. But actually, it's not the case. We have a lot of single people, a lot of older people, a lot of people who enjoy all that vitality and want to be around it, even if they're not married. You know, they don't feel like, you know, it's not like I get up every Sunday and harangue people about this. I just preach scripture as it comes, you know, and some expository preacher and work my way through different books of the Bible. And if the subject comes up in the course of the text, I'll address it. Mm-hmm. But anyway.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I haven't heard that description, but that fits. My wife and I lived in Los Angeles for a time, and we're attending a similar style church. And when we found out we were pregnant with 3, it was like, oh my gosh, like, what are you doing? It's just the city is not conducive to that type of larger family.
Oh, yeah, there's something to think about right there. So you had triplets? Did I hear you correctly?
No. It was just we had 2, under 2, and then got pregnant with our third. Yeah.
Got it. Well, congratulations. I'm glad to know it. Yeah, cities are, particularly modern cities, are designed to atomize us. And what's put front and center in places like Manhattan or Los Angeles, particularly in the downtown area. Now, you could say that it's due to the demand for real estate, and I get that. But it's really difficult to have children in Manhattan or even downtown Boston.
Yeah.
Generally, the people I've known And I lived in Boston. I was involved in urban ministry for a decade. So I'm not, I'm not speaking about these things as though I'm some kind of, Yahoo from the countryside who's never spent time in the city. I've got lots and lots of stories that I could share about my days doing that kind of work. But generally speaking, people, say in Manhattan, who get married and have a child, try to stick around for a little while, but it's pretty predictable. About the time the child reaches about 3 or 4 and the second one's on the way, they're on their way out into, Connecticut or New Jersey.
Yeah.
It's just kind of the way it works.
Yep.
Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't have churches down in the center of the city, but I think we shouldn't think of them in the same way we think about churches in, say, a healthy community. Mm-hmm. I just tip my hand here. I don't think these are healthy communities. I think we should think of them almost as rescue missions for the up and outers. So mm-hmm. you've got rescue missions for the down and outers. You need rescue missions for the up and outers, the people whose priorities were skewed towards success, fame, money, that kind of stuff. And then, experience the price of that or the costs, and then
that's good.
Kind of stop doubling down on dumb and coming, and they come around eventually. I've seen that happen a lot.
Yeah. And that might mean for a lot of them that you're helping them back to where they came from,
Yeah. I think that's right.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. We did the city life with three for a while and eventually ended up moving back to Georgia, and where we have our daughter. So,
nice.
Yeah. It's nice. Much healthier, lifestyle for sure.
Yeah. I had a job offer in LA years ago, back in the early 90s. I would have made me a junk faculty at Fuller Seminary. And, it was with the mother church of a particular denomination I won't name, but I would have been, kind of part of that denomination, sort of historic church. And I turned it down, not because at that time I was in Boston. It wasn't so much the city. It was just, some other factors, but yeah, I know LA pretty well.
Yeah.
In fact, yeah. I was there right before the Rodney King riots. You could feel it in the air. You could sense the tension. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So what would that look like? I'm just following that rabbit trail for a bit. What would that ministry look like that would be different than how a Redeemer would do it?
Well, I don't think we'd begin with trying to get as close to urban cultural assumptions as possible and still retain our Christianity, which is, I think, what happens often in the name of contextualization.
Yeah,
I had a friend years ago who's a black guy. He was brilliant. He went to Harvard when he was 16 years old, became a medical doctor, and then went on to get his MDiv and went on to pastor, plant a church. And I asked him about this. I said, what do you think about contextualization and contextualizing the inner city? He said, why would I want to do that? Hmm. I mean, why would you want to contextualize to death? Hmm. Think about it. That's a lot of what goes on. So what I think what we need to do is, we need to do the work of disillusionment, which is what Ecclesiastes is all about. There's a whole book in the Bible dedicated to talking you out of making this world the primary thing. And so what we want to do is, we need this. Part of the work of an evangelist in a setting like that is to just disillusion people. This is all kind of dumb. What are you really shooting for? Rather than trying to, sanctify it or bless it or put a Jesus, kiss on it or something.
Yeah, no, that's good. Yeah, everything's hevel. yeah, well, this time of year, kind of getting back to the household, this time of year with graduations, we kind of celebrate, sending kids off to university to get that, certification, stamp that, you can get a job. Almost to the expense of telling them, no, don't worry about family, put all that stuff off. Does that need to change if we're going to have churches that really elevate the work of the household?
Yeah, I think so. And it's already happening. I've got a background also in the academy. I was the I've been involved in academic pursuits since the early 90s. I was a college professor. And I've been the vice president of the Academy of Philosophy and Letters. I'm on a college board right now. So I think about this stuff all the time. I actually get the daily email from the Chronicle of Higher Education, which is, you know, just delusional. When you read the headlines, these people are completely out of touch with reality. So, you know, these are the people we're sending our kids off to be educated by. I mean, you know, this is not a good idea. But people are waking up to it and have been waking up for a little while now. I think the whole COVID fiasco was really helpful in that respect. And I think particularly the sinking numbers when it comes to men going to college is actually a good sign. What we should read that as is not a crisis in manhood, but as a crisis in significance for higher education. Mm. If guys really believed that was the only way, they would be willing to go through the gauntlet of woke nonsense. But they're not. They're like saying, "Hey, I can make six figures plumbing, and I don't have to listen to that crapola." Mm-hmm. And the girls, I think that we misread that number too. We have a lot of women enrolled in college, but largely it has to do with the requirements for certification in their, the vocations they want to pursue. So, it's just simply a fact that we're forcing these girls to go to college and to incur tremendous debt. So I'm a landlord. I get to look at credit reports every time one of my apartments opens up. And generally I have, 10 women for every guy applying for my apartments. My apartments are clean. They're nice. They're attractive. They're priced slightly below market rate. So that attracts all these people. And I want you to know, I haven't seen a good credit report from a young woman in years. Mm. They're all a mess. I get good ones from guys, debt-free, but generally it's because they didn't go to college. They're like a mechanic at the Toyota dealership or something, and they've got, $20,000 in the bank. And the girls are broke, credit scores in the low 600s, tens of thousands of dollars of debt, student loan debt, car debt, all kinds of stuff. Now, I'm not saying it's true for every girl, but it's true for a lot of girls with bachelor's degrees and beyond. So yeah, we see the shining example of, say, a girl who works now for the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. We say, well, she's a success. Well, how many other girls are just barely getting by? And when you think about it, it's like a negative dowry. I mean, here's a young man. He gets to know a lady and discovers she's $65,000 in debt. Do you think maybe he takes a second, has second thoughts about maybe pursuing a relationship with her? Mm-hmm. You got a lot of this going on. It's kind of like baseball. I mean, think about baseball. Like, everybody plays baseball, or a lot of kids, at least they used to. But how many guys make it to the majors? And of those who make it to the majors, how many make the really big money? Yeah. Well, that's the way it is with feminism and women getting into the workforce. Yeah, there have been some women who've done really, really well. They're kind of like, the elite stars of, the academic game. But the vast majority are in the minor leagues or washed out. Didn't get past college ball or high school. Yeah. Maybe never even made a little league team. And that's where the vast majority of women are are in the college system. So, I think we need to talk straight to people. And I'm a big believer in higher education, as I noted before. But this idea that everybody has to go to college has always been a dumb idea. And the idea that it was the ticket to a better life isn't the case. Even now, with the rise of artificial intelligence, a lot of the work that I can remember being told you will never be replaced by a machine is being replaced by a machine. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, it's crazy. I'm a software engineer, and just seeing the stuff they do, ChatGPT can take a big portion of the work that
even visual artists
Yeah.
Even visual artists, musicians, people, one of the big things that, occurred in Hollywood here with some of these recent strikes has to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
They're wanting to make certain that they're not being cut out, because you can get even a film score done by AI and stuff like that.
Yeah. Okay. So the household is fundamental building block of,
right.
Now, there's different roles within the household. Can you talk about the difference, the father, the mother, the kids, what role each plays?
Sure. Well, again, we have to kind of step back in time to understand the way things worked prior to the Industrial Revolution. That was a huge, development in the history of the world. And I don't think we're going to go back to the way things were, but I do think what we can do is push forward into a world where I hope we can have the best of both. So there are certain things about the traditional household that were great and have suffered with the Industrial Revolution. There are certain things about the Industrial Revolution that are great that I don't want to lose. So, what do we want to do? We want to kind of push forward and see if there might be a way to make households productive again in the way they used to be. So getting back to your question about roles, there are some obvious there's kind of an obvious natural division of labor in a traditional household. Now, I know there's a lot of experimentation and goofiness and, stuff, but in a traditional household, before the Industrial Revolution, generally speaking, in fact, here, a great book on the subject was Xenophon's Oikonomikos, which was originally published, I believe, in the 4th century BC. It was kind of like Rich Dad, Poor Dad in antiquity. Cicero translated into Latin. Everybody knew about it. Xenophon was a contemporary of Plato. He was actually a student of Socrates. And so it's a Socratic dialogue, just like Plato's dialogues. And in that dialogue, Socrates is interviewing two different household heads, one whose household is failing and one whose is successful. And what he's trying to do is he's trying to assess why one is failed and why one succeeded. And it's pretty commonsensical stuff. One of the things that the interlocutor that Socrates is talking with, who is a success, as he says, I have a very basic understanding of the division of labor between men and women. Men are outside, women are inside. And the women tend to like it that way. So outdoor work is man's work, indoor work is woman's work. Doesn't mean that a man never does anything in the house, and it doesn't mean women don't ever do anything outside. But he said there's just kind of a basic division. And then obviously women are mothers and men are fathers. I know that's controversial today, but that was pretty commonsensical once upon a time. And then when it came to the defense of the household or representing the household in civic sphere, that was a man's job. So you see it even in something like the Patriot with Mel Gibson. Mm-hmm. I mean, even up into early colonial times, that was the same sort of structure. And people didn't call it into question. People weren't chafing at the bit trying to, promote, women's suffrage or anything like that. Women had a vote. They had influence, but it was through the head of the house. So a house would have a vote. Houses that have productive property would have a vote in civil affairs. And all you need to do is look at the correspondence between John Adams and his wife to realize he and her were talking about public matters. And, he was listening to her and getting her thoughts on things and helping to formulate his own, what he wanted to say for his household. That was the way things worked. Now there were tasks, in cultures all around the world in which women were engaged in public life, but often they were not in civil affairs related to law, because that would mean enforcement. These are the days before police forces. So usually the things that were determined that we need to enforce, the guys who decided they needed to be enforced were the guys who did the enforcing, that kind of thing. And then, when it came to military concerns, we're not talking about drones and, sitting in an office and having a virtual reality experience while you're engaged in warfare. You're talking about actually fighting with swords and clubs and stuff like that. So men were charged with the responsibility of maintaining civil order and protecting the periphery. And so that's how the kind of the basic breakdown worked. But everybody in the household was involved in productive enterprise. So you could be, it could be, you know, a subsistence farm. It could be a larger operation where you're growing things for the market. It could be a trade, coopers, smiths, you know, cobblers. They all, you know, had their storefronts and they lived right next to where they worked. And the wife and the children were usually involved. I think you'd say always involved in the work. So, you know, the conversation at the dinner table might be, we need more pig iron. Can you order that? We need to make sure that Mr. Johnson finally pays his bill. Can you let him know that kind of stuff? It wasn't like we need to get Johnny to soccer practice. Or, you know, what are we having for dinner tonight? Although I imagine that was part of the conversation, but, the work of the household was central. So obviously that's not as much the case anymore, but I do think we're seeing something of a recovery. And it's paradoxical because what's helping to fuel the recovery or to further it is actually technology.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I've been working remote for 7 years, and it's, you know, during that time COVID happened and, you know, we started homeschooling, and that's just been cool to kind of get to be here and a part of that and kind of turn our home into just a place that we kind of retreat to at the end of the day to enjoy leisure, turn it into a productive home, like you've talked about. And that's it's been cool to see that. And it is the technology, like we're talking now, that enables me to do this from here and help out and help with math questions and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's been great.
It's great. I'm glad for you.
Yeah. So what are some concrete steps that people can take, that Christians can take to make their homes more productive?
Well, I think the first thing to do is make the kind of a paradigm shift, and you've made it, to no longer think of your house as strictly a retreat, a place to go to get away from things, a haven in a heartless world, as they used to put it, but actually think of it as a center of productive activity. Now, that productive activity can take different forms. You know, homeschooling is productive activity. So, you know, a homeschooling home is a productive household. When you are caring for your elderly parents, and you have them come maybe and live in the, you know, the ADU, the alternative dwelling unit, or maybe the part of the house that you renovated to make it possible for them to be with you, and then you care for them, that's productive. Then, you know, there are subsistence activities, things like, you know, maybe you want to have a big garden, or maybe you want to have some livestock, or, you know, those are traditionally ways that people start pulling in things to their direct control that maybe they completely relied on others for before. And then, of course, there's participating in the larger economy. So you do that as you know, a computer programmer. But there are lots of ways to do that. And I've got, I would say, probably in my church, a good 30 to 50% of the men do that. And it wasn't necessarily that they pursued that. It was just kind of like fell into their laps, and now they're glad for it. And in some cases, they pursued it. Like I've got an elder in my church who has a multi-million-dollar company, but it's entire, and he's got probably, I don't know, 50 to 70 employees. They're all virtual, and they live, you know, all over the Western Hemisphere. In fact, I think he has some in South Africa. but they work on an ongoing basis, on a daily basis this way. And so there's, you know, there's that. And then, you know, my wife, for example, your listeners maybe can hear her teaching piano. She's been doing that for 30 years or more. She's got between 20 and 40 students at any given time. So we've always had a steady stream of people coming through the house. We own rental properties. You know, that's something, that's another thing that, and then when my kids were small, they were not small, but you know, when they get to the teen years, we'd go and I'd have them work on those with me. So those are, you know, basically, I guess, your imagination, and your skills, are the limit.
Yeah.
So
now household, it can't just be an island, you know, we're called to live in community. How can churches, pastors begin to foster that kind of thick Christian community in their churches where these sort of households thrive?
Yeah, I think there are a few things that are helpful. One is, you know, if you have people living in a general sort of generally close to each other, that helps. Now, sometimes that can be challenging because maybe your church draws from a wide area. And that's true for us. There are people who drive over an hour to church every Sunday in my church from all over the place. So, you know, these people are like 3 hours from each other because they're coming from different directions, mm-hmm. you know. But there are also people who live in fairly close proximity to each other. It helps if you've got some businesses in the church. So in my case, we have several entrepreneurs and their businesses are pretty successful. And consequently, they're working with each other throughout the week. And the families get to know each other because they have connections, not just on Sunday, but throughout the week with each other. Then there are extended family dynamics. You know, so we've got a number of significant extended family networks in our church. And those things have been helpful. Now, I can't take credit for any of those. It's not like I got up one Sunday and said, okay, I want you guys to start businesses and hire some of our people. Mm-hmm. That's not how it happened. They just did it. They were compelled because of, well, you know, ambition, which I think can be a good thing. But also a sense that their vocation, it comes from God and they wanted to pursue the vocation, and be successful with it. And as these endeavors have prospered, they've been looking for employees and just so happens that there've been people in church who could use the work. And so it's kind of grown organically that way. So I think that's kind of the way you go about it. I don't think you start out with a grand master plan and say, we are going to have this, kind of thing. You just kind of move iteratively. Mm-hmm. And you look for opportunities and you connect and you work together. So I think houses have to work together. I don't think households were ever intended to be understood as completely self-sufficient. They're part of a larger, you could say, cultural ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And if you read Aristotle, he's very clear about that. That's where the politics goes right off the bat. He starts with the household and then moves to the city.
Yeah. And I guess that kind of takes us to this kind of war for the cosmos. Can you explain what that is and how the household connects to that?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, we can understand households in different ways. You know, one secular way or non sort of theistic way to think about it is it was just something that happened kind of to make farming possible or something like that at a certain point in human development. And consequently, we can say, well, you know, we can live without it. We're discovering that we can't. The global collapse in fertility, I think, there's something to kind of the corrosive effects of industrialization that is finally coming back to bite us. And we, you know, you could live off of immigration for a while, but now the global fertility crisis is global. You know, you know, we're going to run out of immigrants someday. So we need to figure out a way to get past this impasse. But when it comes to the theological framework within which we can understand this, we can see that households are established by God. It's the first household is Adam and Eve's, right? So there you go. So Adam shouldn't be alone, we're told. You know, it's not good that it's for him to be alone. So he's given someone who's just the right helper to him. He can't reproduce on his own. You know, he can't fill the world. You know, he needs Eve's help for that. And also, I think implied is that there are a whole range of things that he depends on her for and she depends on him for. So in this way of thinking about things, interdependency is a goal, not independence. But the household itself reflects a larger order. So the word cosmos in most minds just means outer space, but that's a very contemporary way of thinking about the word. What it used to mean is an order, kind of the largest order of them all. And microcosms, small orders, are reflections of the larger order. So you can think about it in terms of like a tree. When you think about a tree, it's really kind of a series of fractals. You have the large, you know, sort of structure, but then that large structure is reflected or reproduced or recapitulates in the smaller structures, branches, twigs, leaves. They all have the same kind of structure, but each one depends on the other. So the large structure depends on the small structures, and the small structures depend on the large structure. What do you have with a tree that doesn't have leaves anymore? A dead tree. What do you have with a leaf that's no longer attached to the tree? A dead leaf. But when they work together, you know, you've got some kind of larger order. And the same thing is true by analogy with the larger order. So like when we think about the largest order of all, we can think about, you know, Christ and the church. And that, as we see in scripture, is understood in terms of the household. You know, there's the groom, there's the bride, all of that. Now, one of the reasons why historically we refer to the church as Mother Church, is that it's where new Christians are born and nurtured and cared for and prepared. So that's a very appropriate analog to, you know, a mother. A mother is a very appropriate analog to that.
Interesting. Okay, so as we bring order to our own individual households, we are part of these interconnected things that are bringing order to society. Is that, am I kind of following there?
Yeah. I think that's right. And we're mimesis. There's a kind of a mimicry that goes on. It's not like we make up this stuff out of thin air. We've got a model. You know, think about it this way. When we think about the tabernacle in the wilderness, it's not just an arbitrary construct. It's actually, as we see in Hebrews, a miniature, a kind of a regional office of the great throne, you know, of heaven. So it's the heavenly order reflected in a smaller order. So the same thing is true when we think about, you know, Christ and the church and our households. Our households reflect that order. It's not so much that the Apostle Paul was thinking, well, what can I use as an analog to try to explain the relationship of Christ and the church? It wasn't like he was moving from here to there. He was doing it the other way. Mm. He's saying, this is the way the heavenlies work. That's why things work this way here.
Gotcha. What are some common ways that you see that Christian households are disordered today?
Well, they're too atomized. You know, everything is sort of, you know, every kid has his own television set or his own little screen he carries around with them. You know, there's no sort of thing that pulls everybody together. There should be, you know, at the very minimum, you know, a coming together for you know, worship and prayer and devotion in a household, but also just at a physical level, food. You know, these two things have they draw us together. But then the idea that we're working together, toward a common purpose, the glory of God. But that also includes just daily meeting daily needs, making sure that we're getting things done. So that has to be inculcated in. So today, we still have this dynamic in our family, even though we're in different places. I'm here in Washington State, and my children and their households are in different places. We're interacting with each other, not just, socially, but actually productively. So my kids are involved with our family's productive enterprises.
That's cool. Yeah, we one of the things we've tried to do is just like hospitality when we're invite people over. It's not me and mommy doing this and you're gonna run around and create a big mess with the other kids. We as a family, common enterprise, we are extending hospitality.
So yeah, that's
we
great.
Want you to be a good guest or a good host as well.
Right.
So yeah, anything we can do to kind of involve our kids in what the household is doing.
That's super.
That's great. Well, Chris, I don't want to keep you too long. This has been just fascinating conversation. I hope it kind of sparked some thoughts with my listeners. Before I let you go, I always like to end each show with a white pill for our listeners. What is something that is giving you hope right now?
Oh, wow. I think the thing that's giving me hope is something that a lot of folks interpret as bad news, and that is the fertility crisis globally. Mm. I think we're in the early stages of the collapse or the death of the sexual revolution. And I think it's death by its own hand. So I'm pretty sure, I'm no Nostradamus. I remember one time I said that to somebody and he said, neither was he. But I can't tell the future, but I can extrapolate a bit. And what we can say is this year, the world as a whole, not just Western civilization or Eastern, like Japan and Korea, are now in negative growth. So the current global birth rate is below replacement rate, and it's only going to get worse. It's only going to accelerate. So in light of that, I believe that we don't need to worry long term about cheap sex and transgenderism or gay marriage. I think all that stuff is just going to be looked at as, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? You know, we can't take care of things. We can't keep the economy going. And you're doing what? So I think the argument, when God argues, history happens. Hmm. You know, God doesn't just sit there and like say, why can't I get through this guy? No, God judges. And when God judges, things happen. And we are in a phase of the modern project where we're starting to see consequences, particularly with the sexual revolution. Now, we've seen consequences with the sexual revolution for a while, but they haven't been civilization crisis consequences. But we're at that point. And it's just beginning. It's just beginning. So in terms of a white pill, I tell the ladies in my church who've got more than three kids, you will go from pariah to hero in the course of your lifetime.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I hope you're right there, that the sexual revolution needs to die. Can't happen to it soon enough.
Yeah. If you just leave it alone, it will. I mean, that was the containment policy of the United States during the Cold War. Just cut them off.
Yeah.
They only survive by, parasitically.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Chris. I've enjoyed this. Where can people find you?
Well, I'm a co-host of another podcast, the Theology Podcast. And that's a podcast that, comes out every week. So there's that. Then, of course, there are the books I write, and I write for different magazines like World Magazine. I'm an editor at Touchstone Magazine.
Awesome. Well, I will definitely include links to that stuff in the show notes. So thank you so much, Chris. I enjoyed this.
Yeah, me too, Josh. Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today. Big thanks to C.R. Wiley for joining me for this conversation. If you enjoyed this, I'll have links in the show notes where you can find more of Chris's work and purchase his books there as well. If you found this helpful, please share it with a friend. Go ahead and hit like and subscribe so you don't miss future content. And if you're listening, ratings and reviews over at Apple Podcast are always appreciated. Until next time, I will talk to you soon.